right. Well, I hope you're enjoying the Alden Report as much as I am. I'm having so much fun bringing you cutting-edge information and from entrepreneurs, from thought leaders, from authors all over the world. And I'm really excited to announce something. I'm speaking this September of 2018, at the Future Tech Expo in Dallas, Texas. It's actually September 14th, 15th, and 16th, and I'm speaking there. It's an amazing event. It's one of the biggest blockchain, Bitcoin, and tech expos in the world. People like Tim Draper and Randy Zuckerberg are going to be there, and you can rub elbows with some of the smartest people in this world. September 14th, 15th, and 16th. If you text BLUEVASE, again, text BLUEVASE to 555-888, you can be my VIP. I'm going to give you some discounted tickets, but you can also be my VIP. There's an opportunity as well to have dinner with me and my team, and we're going to sit down and we're going to talk about this world of cryptocurrency, of Bitcoin, of blockchain, and the future of technology. Again, text BLUEVASE to 555-888. If you want to be involved in this world, if you want to grow in this world, if you want to take advantage of the biggest opportunity of your life, then you need to be at events like the Future Tech Expo. Again, text BLUEVASE to 555-888. I'll see you there. All right, well, my name is Michael Alden. We are here in BLUEVASE Studios. My guest is actually here in studio today, and I'm pretty excited to have my next guest. We're going to be talking about a subject that impacts most likely every single person in the United States in one way or another. He has an amazing story. He's been impacted by addiction, again, like many of the people that we know. For me, it's something that's very personal. For those of you that know me, I have had a lot of family members that have had some major addiction challenges throughout their life. And my next guest, his name is Jason Hyland. He wrote the book called Stop Thinking Like That. And I've known him for a little while, and he's got a really, really inspiring story. But what I really love about his stories is that it's relatable. And when you read it and when you understand it, it's something that, you know, the average everyday person can read it and say, you know what, if I've gone through that, or if I know somebody that's going through that, and you get a copy of his book, I've read the book, I don't have it here with me, it's actually due out in June, I think it's really, really going to help people. So I'm really, really excited to have him here in the studio. Jason, thanks so much for being my guest.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Mike.
So let's start for a second. And just tell our viewers and listeners a little bit about yourself. You're obviously from the North Shore. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up, how you grew up, and then we'll just kind of riff from there.
All right. I'm born and raised here in Beverly, actually.
Bring the mic a little closer.
Born and raised here in Beverly, and growing up was just all about sports. My older brother, older sister played three sports. I played three sports. It was just all basically we knew. It was just ingrained in us to play. Went to a good all-boys Catholic high school, played baseball and football there, and then got the opportunity to basically choose my college for either sport, and I chose baseball down in Florida, University of Tampa.
Why'd you choose baseball over football? I always wondered that. People always have that decision. Why'd you choose baseball? Is it less injuries?
No.
More money?
I knew I had a chance to make it to the major leagues. Okay. In baseball. I didn't have a chance in the NFL.
All right.
And baseball has always been my number one. It's been my passion. It's been my everything since the beginning. So
right.
It was a pretty easy choice. I played in Florida before for AAU tournaments. And when I got down there, it was everything I wanted it to be.
Right.
And it was a great experience. But that's where kind of the partying started.
Right.
And my sophomore year, we made it to the College World Series.
Let me stop you there for a second, because I know this guy a little bit, so we're from the same town. So, but before that, though, you know, I talked about my family, right? And my family has been riddled with addiction. I know that you definitely have some family members that also suffered with addiction. Tell me a little bit about that. What was it like? I mean, your father was an alcoholic, right?
Yes, unfortunately, right? He passed away on Christmas morning 2 years ago.
Yeah,
from alcoholism. So I saw it firsthand exactly what the disease of alcoholism does.
Right.
I saw the body go from this big brute Hulk, as I thought, to...
Because he was a great athlete in his day, right? Back in the day as well, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Softball, yeah. And hockey.
Yeah.
And, you know, it definitely wore off on the kids, which was great, but it also, the gene wore off on me in regards to the alcoholism. So I didn't realize it at the time when I started drinking in high school and college.
Right.
But now looking back, I absolutely understand where it came from and how it got to the point it did.
Did you think back then, you know, growing up, because again, a lot of... households with kids that grow up, it's a very common story. Addiction then, you know, passes on to them, and we can get into the debate whether or not it's genetic or not. But growing up, you know, in that environment, was it a problem in your family, or you know, was there chaos in the family like some, or did you just think your life was just normal?
For me, I thought it was normal.
Yeah,
but I also knew no one else, none of my friends growing up had that type of, you know, family dynamic, I guess you could say.
Right.
And were there some issues? Of course, like any other family.
Right.
We definitely had some more major issues that I really don't want to digress too much into.
Right.
But there were problems, yes, and I realized later on that that wasn't normal. What I thought was normal of having that type of lifestyle was absolutely not normal.
Right.
But, you know, again, it didn't really kick into me until much later in life.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's difficult, again, as you're a kid and you just don't know what else is, like you said, what else is normal until you know, it's maybe even it's too late. So the reason why I bring it up, too, is because, you know, in where we grew up, and it seems as though that drinking was not that big of a deal to, like you said, high school. High school kids were drinking. I think I started drinking in the eighth grade, you know, and it just didn't – our parents knew about it, and the way our parents you know, addressed it, it was almost like it was just kind of a rite of passage. And for some, it's not really an issue. But there is also a lot of people where that's where it all starts, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you hear it a lot in the halls of AA that I knew it right from the first drink I had. Now, it's hard for me to fathom that. I certainly didn't. I was just having a good time. Like you said, like it seemed like everyone else would.
Right.
It was a rite of passage. And it's just going with the flow, the progress of being a young adult into adulthood and so forth.
Right.
So I didn't see anything wrong with it really at the time. I still don't, to be honest with you.
Right.
And I started when I was 16.
Yeah. Did you get in any trouble at all when you were in high school? Any alcohol related incidences that when you look back on it and say, man, those maybe it was starting then?
Yeah, there was a couple fights.
Yeah.
Where I seemed to always be stepping in front of my friends and taking care of their backs.
Oh, yeah, I feel that, man.
My mother likes to remind me of that to this day.
Right.
We're always fighting everyone else's battles.
Right.
And she's right. You know, I never really focused on trying to take care of myself. I would take care of everyone else.
Because right.
One thing I really don't like is seeing, you know, people getting picked on. And
right.
People who can't defend themselves.
Right.
And when that happened, I would step in. And, of course, there was alcohol involved in those incidents.
Right. Right. So, all right. So you're great high school athlete, and again, I think your story, and I, like I said, I've read his book. We're here with Jason Hyland. He's got an amazing story. We're going to get into his whole story about addiction, about recovery, about how to properly train your mind, and it's just a great story. So if you're already up until this point and you really want more information about Jason, you can just go to Jason-Hyland. And by the way, it's HYLAND.com. You can pick up his book, Stop Thinking Like That. It's available now for pre-order on Amazon, so you can pick that up. It's available digitally as well. Did you do an audiobook as well? Are you going to do an audiobook?
I'm going to. I haven't got it.
Probably he's
going
to have that available as well. So again, so we're talking with Jason first about the beginnings of his life. And I wanted to get into that because I think your story is very common. Not some of the successes that you've had, but it's common where it all kind of starts, right? Because I've seen it. So you get to college, and you're this stud athlete, and things start to things feel like they're great. But tell us about that first, you know, experience being there as that, you know, stud athlete, and then, you know, how things maybe started to go down the road that they shouldn't have.
Well, it actually started my freshman year. I was a walk-on at Tampa, mm-hmm. and I started after my third game as a freshman, playing right field, batting like seventh or eighth, and it was the first time in my life I failed.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't doing what I was used to in on the diamonds, and so it definitely got the best of me. I didn't know how to handle it, how to handle the failure, and my attitude changed, the drinking probably increased, and my coach just released me down to the JV team. So I left that summer, and I came back in this fall, and he didn't think I was going to come back. So I had to earn my spot back onto that team. And my sophomore year, I started every game, but there was another incident. I had my jaw broken, jaw wired shut I missed 13 games. Of course, that was alcohol-related.
Right. On campus? Was it on campus?
Off campus.
Yeah.
It was my girlfriend at the time, her birthday, celebrating, and one thing led to the next.
Right.
I got jumped, and I had to fly up here to have the surgery.
Right.
Which was horrific. If anyone's ever had that, it is terribly,
yeah,
terribly painful. So when I came back from that, again, I had to earn it.
Hold on a second. So I want to just think about the dynamics of that. So you come back, you're a sophomore. Were you living with your father at the time? Well, when you came back home, did you live with dad when you came back home? No?
No. I actually...
I guess the reason why is because knowing a little bit about, again, your past and how a lot of families handle that. So you get into a ballroom brawl, essentially, and, you know, for the tough dad, you know, athlete, stud type guy, was it just like, whatever, no big deal. He got the best year. How the other guy, you know, you should see what the other guy looked like. Was it taken seriously, or was it, you know, I mean, because that's a pretty severe injury, you know, in a fight. But what was the reaction to your family circle?
Well, to be honest, I was pretty estranged from my father at that point.
Okay.
When I left for college till I was about 27, 28, yeah, I didn't have much communication with him.
Okay.
Except for on holidays when I would visit.
Right.
And it was just, you know, I flew up here via my mother and my right. stepfather and got that all taken care of.
Okay.
And they, of course, were not happy with what happened.
Right.
And versus the other side of it, like you just said, it's a fight. It happens.
Right.
So I steered away from that side of the family in regards to the issues because I knew where it would lead to.
Right.
And then going back, you know, all my successes in college, he wasn't a part of, but my brother was, which was really great. And
right.
obviously my mother and such. So it really, when I left for college, things got a little dicey, I guess you could say, between my father and I.
Right.
Just how I handled it. I just didn't want to be around some things, and you know, it took me about 10 years to finally come back here and move in with him and take care of him
right.
for the last years of his life.
So, all right. So, I want to go back to your sophomore year. So, you break, you know, you have that incident. You break the jaw. Coach obviously can probably tell that something's going on, but gives you that another, you know, opportunity. So, you get back. You make it back on the team. You're doing well. Sophomore year. What's going on now? What's going on in your sophomore year?
Yeah, it was like I just didn't miss a beat. I had to wear a special helmet when I hit, and then on the base pass, I had a football mask over me.
Yeah,
it was pretty pretty intense.
Yeah.
But we made it to the College World Series. I helped my team get to the College World Series and to the championship game. We lost in the national championship game to Central Missouri State. And as we're, you know, sobbing in the dugout, watching them pigpile, I hear my name over the loudspeaker, and it's, you know, MVP of the College World Series, Jason Hyland.
Mm.
So it was a very bittersweet moment. It was bittersweet because obviously my goal coming there was to come home with a ring.
Right.
Instead, I come home with a absolutely incredible honor
right.
in front of my brother, my mother, my stepfather,
right.
My girlfriend at the time. They were all there to witness that. So it was a great moment in that regards.
Right.
But the team aspect, we didn't pull it off.
Right.
But that's really what set things in motion in regards to the major leagues. The draft was absolutely going to happen. The major leagues were a possibility, like seeing what I was doing, what I was producing against who I was producing.
Right. So that's your sophomore year. So at that point, when you talk about the major leagues, did you feel as though, or did you know that you were being looked at? I mean, was it a real possibility? Because, you know, I thought I could play D1 because of my size, but I realized when I went to a camp actually with your stepbrother Kevin, I realized no, I can't. But when you're there playing at that high level, was it pretty real to you? I mean, were there scouts coming to games and things like that, or?
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. So when I returned from my junior year in fall ball, I had a long discussion with my coach about where I was and where he saw me going, because your junior year is when you can get drafted.
Right.
In baseball, you have to wait till at least your junior year in
right.
college. So I had everything right in front of me. It was all lined up the way I envisioned it years ago, and it was, you know, it was coming to fruition. But then an incident happened.
Yeah.
The last straw at Tampa, and I was just kicked off the team. Like a month into fall ball.
Yeah.
And it was because we had a recruit staying with us, a high school recruit. Took him out to the bars. A fight broke out. Again, I jumped in for my friend.
Right.
I got injured. Coach just the next morning said, "You're done. I'll grant you your release," which was a blessing. And you know, best.
What does that mean? I'll grant you a release.
It means I didn't have to take a year off.
Okay.
I could play immediately.
Right. Somewhere else.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, I was devastated.
Right.
I was absolutely devastated. My parents, were devastated. Like, here we go again, it seemed like, because like now you can see the incidents are starting
right.
to creep up and add up. And
were you one of those? Were you one of those kids? People talk about natural abilities, and we have to bring it for a whole nother podcast. But were you one of those athletes that you could go out to the bars the night before and play in a game as if nothing happened?
Yes.
Yeah. See, that's a problem, right? When you look back on it, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, I can get away with it.
Right.
If you go, you know, go out that night till 2 o'clock, you don't have to be at the field till 4.
Right.
You know, in the afternoon, you have a great game. Like, oh, I can do that again.
Right.
And then that's just, it's how it, you know, it increases, and you know, you lose control before you know it. That's for sure.
And that's important, right? For a lot of people, like student athletes, whether they're in high school or they're in college, if you think about that, because the reason why I bring it up, because I know guys that I went to college with that were exactly like that. They were just naturally great athletes. But yet, you know, I always had to work at it, and I wasn't even anywhere close to some of these guys, and they were out all night drinking and doing drugs, and they just get them on the field and just you know set records. But then at some point, it catches up to you, right? You're not always going to be an 18, 19 years old.
Yeah, absolutely. It starts catching up to your body, and your body starts reacting the way it should from partying all the time. And it's funny, I think back to all the kids I played with, whether high school or college, that actually made it to the major leagues.
Right.
Made it to the very high levels.
Right.
Almost every single one of them never partied, never
right.
touched alcohol or drugs. And it makes sense to me. Because if I did that, I absolutely would have been in the same predicament.
Right.
But no, that wasn't the choice I made, obviously.
So, all right, so take me to your junior year. So we get to your junior year, then what happens? We make it out of the junior year? What happens?
Yeah, we transferred to a school in California.
Yeah.
One of the Cal State schools, Chico State.
Mm-hmm.
I sent my resume to a handful of schools when I got released, and I got two scholarship offers, Boston College here back home and Chico State. Chico State lost in the College World Series in the national championship.
Let me pause for a second. So Boston College, which is a – I don't know anything about Chico State, but we're here in Boston, so we know Boston College is a great school. So your grades must have been half decent, right?
Yeah, I graduated the prep with just under 4.0.
Wow.
And
But your college grades must have been decent too then, right? I mean, if Boston College is going to take you.
They haven't fallen off at that point.
Yeah, oh, okay. All right, so they were still – so your grades are still acceptable at that point.
Yes.
Right,
yes.
Okay.
And
all right.
I chose to go to Chico over Boston College because, one, baseball, they're a better team.
Right.
It's plain and simple. They are a better team, even though it's D2.
Right.
We win 7 out of 10 times.
Right.
The other part was the majority of kids I played in high school with or played against were already on the team at BC.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do something different.
Right.
And I'd never been to California, so why not? They lost in the championship game my freshman year. I lost my sophomore year.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if we can come together and, you know, figure it out and try to get to the top there. And we made it to 2 consecutive College World Series, so we went to 3 in a row, but we never won anything, unfortunately.
Wow. What position did you play? I forget.
Center field and right field.
Okay.
Mostly right field after my freshman year.
Yeah. So you graduated there?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So you finished up there, but during that time, obviously things from an addiction standpoint aren't really getting any better, right? So is it mostly alcohol?
It was alcohol going into Chico, but that's when things really took a turn and the drugs became a factor.
Yeah.
And my junior year was well. After my junior year, my coach pulled me aside just like I had the year before.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if you just go about it the way you're supposed to, you'll be in the top 10 round draft pick.
Right.
That was music to my ears.
Right.
Obviously. And then we had a pro day in the fall. I did really well. I had to fill out paperwork for multiple teams. And again, I'm back to the, okay, it's back on track again. Here we go. But my senior year was just an absolute disaster. And it was because drugs were completely involved at this point.
So one of the interesting things I think about, athletes, and because, I played Division II. I never even started a game. But I know what it's like to – at least for me at the high school level, to be at the top and you truly do hit a high, right? So you are high in a way. I mean, the same chemical reaction basically happens when you win a big game, right? I mean, you all these chemicals are released in your brain. That's why you feel the way you feel.
Absolutely.
So when you get to that point, let's say where your coach says you're going into your senior year now. So and the coach says to you, man, you know, keep doing what you're doing. Congratulations. You're probably going to end up in the pros. You're probably at that high, right? You probably felt that high. And then, but at some point, it doesn't stay with you, right? So what I always wanted to know, and I've actually listened to some other interviews. I heard of, I think it was Brett Favre had talked about it. Junior Seau talked about it before. You know, where you're at this point where you have that high and you can't get it again. And so the only way you can get it is you take something that creates that false feeling, right?
Yeah.
Is that accurate? Does that sound about right, or what happens? Like, or am I going too far?
I can see that because, like you said, there's certain chemicals you're going to release when you're just on a natural high. It's
right.
Like going to the gym. When I leave the gym nowadays, it's like unbelievable.
Right.
High.
Right.
And similar to when using substances, to an extent, yes. Obviously, you're not going to react the same, but I can see how you get like, all right, I reached my threshold. That's the plateau of where I'm going, and you try to have something else to replicate that feeling, and slowly but surely, it can lead to, you know, a full blown addiction.
Right. All right. In a second, we're going to get into your senior year and how things really start to go downhill. But folks, you know, again, we're here with Jason Hyland. The story gets better, and that's why he's here today. He wrote an amazing book. I've had an opportunity to read the book before it's been out. It's actually due out June 1st. You can pick it up. It's called Stop Thinking Like That. If you want some more information about Jason Hyland, you can just go to jason-hyland.com. You can also find him pretty much everywhere on social media, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, Jason R. Hyland. You know, he's out there. He's changing people's lives. His story, we haven't even really got into some of the negative part of what has happened in his life, but he's really turned it around, and he's helping other people, which is great. And he recently just spoke before a bunch of politicians and law enforcement professionals right here in Massachusetts. It was an amazing speech. You can actually find that on YouTube as well. So if you want more information about Jason, you can go to jason-hyland.com. You're doing some speaking stuff too, right? Some people can hire you to come speak to their group and talk a little bit about, you know, your story and what you've done as well, right?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
So, all right. So we get to, and again, I for those listening and watching right now, again, if you didn't hear me in the beginning, addiction has ruined my family's life. I've been fortunate enough to not be in that category. But I, you know, Jason and I were talking before. If I do have an addiction, it's probably food. It's probably not as bad as some of the other stuff. You know, there are ways out of it. And that's where we're going to get into that in a second. So you get to your senior year. And things, like you said, start to really go downhill. Why did you first take that first drug? I'm guessing it was probably like an oxy or something, or, you know, when people are drinking, that's usually what they do. Like, I'll just pop a pill, right? I mean, tell me about that experience and what was, looking back on it, what do you think was really going through your head when you said, I'm just, you know, going to take that leap?
I kind of look at it just like when you started drinking. Mm-hmm. You see everyone else doing it. Mm-hmm. It seems normal. It's just part of the progression into adulthood. And they're having a good time. Why not try it? And
right.
See, you know, we'll try it and just see how it goes.
Right. What was it?
Actually, my first drug I ever took was ecstasy when I was 14.
Okay.
Which is crazy to think of because I didn't drink until I was 16 and a half.
Right.
But college-wise, it was...
That's interesting. Let me stop you there for a second, because what I've always thought of, for me, psychologically, there are certain barriers that you can just cross within the drug world or within anything. You know, it's like, for me, I was like, oh, so drinking is one. And I always used to think of, when you cross that barrier from a legal drug, which was alcohol, even though it was illegal to drink it when you're a kid, to a illegal drug, which for me was marijuana, and there's nothing. You jumped right to something that was even before alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just a once or twice thing.
Yeah.
It was when it was really the it drug
right.
at the time. This was
right.
We're talking late 90s.
Right.
And it was just a one or two time thing.
Right.
And it happened again later in life.
Yeah.
You know, but...
And that is one of those. That is one of those drugs that does exactly what I was just talking about, which gives you that absolute euphoria, and you just feel amazing, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's a great feeling.
So, senior year of college, drinking's going on. What are you taking now? What would you take?
Out there, it became cocaine.
Oh, it's cool. Okay. Which is also going to give you the high energy, I feel great type,
yep.
Right?
You're replacing the feeling. I was replacing the feeling on the field from playing now
right.
at night to using cocaine. I was selling it and using it pretty
right.
much almost every day my senior year, which
yeah.
it's crazy to think of now.
What's that? So is it, I mean, is it that feeling of invincibility? Is do you just at first, you know, because you always hear about it, you hear about the history of cocaine and you know, that so many people throughout history have used it, you know, recreationally. I think Sherlock Holmes like injected it. So I mean, when you've taken it, what's it really feel like? For those who have never taken I've never done cocaine. So, I mean, I've taken stimulants, and people say, well, it's kind of like that, you know. Tell us what it's like what do you feel like when you first do it?
Thinking about it now, I get sick to my stomach. Mm-hmm. I truly do. It's this feeling of absolutely disgust. But when you're doing it and not abusing it, you're going to feel, you know, that quick high.
Mm-hmm.
You feel like you can socialize, talk with anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel kind of like alcohol, the life of the party, so
right.
to speak, and you're continuously going.
Right.
People are start winding down, you're just getting ready and keep going.
Right.
And it allows you to drink a lot more.
Right.
There's no doubt about that. And so the party lasts a lot longer.
Right.
The next morning usually isn't as fun, obviously.
Right.
But
so that's the problem, too, where you see, and you can almost tell, I've been around people that, you know, that you can tell they're doing something else because of the amount that they're drinking, and they just continue to do that. So, yeah, that next morning is got to be, I mean, so you, for those of you that have drank before, you drink, you wake up, you have a hangover, you feel like crap, you know, as you get older, like me, I don't recover as well, so I try not to drink that much anymore. But if you're taking that stimulant that's making you feel better and speeding you up and you're drinking more, the alcohol is still having the same effect in your body. It's just you're able to keep your, like, adrenal glands going. I don't really know. Like,
you're increasing the dosage of alcohol,
right,
which
right.
means your interior is getting even more and more, you know, pushed to that threshold that
right.
I was talking about, where it's not going to work anymore.
Right.
And you're going to start hurting yourself more than, you know, enjoying that time.
Right.
Now, one thing I can say, though, is I never did coke before any games. Like, I never did it the night before games. That was one thing I stuck to for what it's worth.
So no basketball diaries type thing?
No basketball diaries, no Josh Hamiltons.
Okay.
And I couldn't do that. I was too scared.
Mm-hmm.
I was honestly too scared. Like,
yeah, but you know, it's interesting. I've heard of guys that played baseball at your level, and they Adderall was like seemed to be the drug of choice. I remember actually a friend of mine told me he actually got drafted by the Red Sox. And he said that when he would take Adderall, not on a prescription, someone else's, that he could almost see he could see the laces on the ball, and it was almost like the ball slowed down because he was able to focus. I find it interesting that you wouldn't want to at least try it at then, you know, try the coke then to see how you would react.
I was just too scared. My heart would like jump out.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Honest, yeah,
right.
So, but with Adderall, anything in that category, your focus is extremely on point.
Right.
There's no doubt about that.
So when does it really fall apart for you? Like, when does it there's people always talk about the bottom and the rock bottom, things like that. But so let's talk about college. Like, when does it really you realize that things are probably just really out of control?
When I was counting down the days to get out of Dodge, get out of California, go move back home with my family in Florida now where they were.
Why were you counting down the days?
Because I couldn't handle doing this anymore.
Okay, so you knew that it was that there was something needed to be done. So you were at least that aware of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So it was, as much as I enjoyed my time out in Chico and in California in general, I knew that I was ready to go.
Right.
I was ready to get out of there. Change of scenery hopefully would help, which we'll learn later on doesn't do
right.
the job.
Yeah, and so, but that's interesting. Don't you see? I mean, I know that you're helping a lot of people now. You're talking to people, speaking at different places. The self awareness thing, I think, is a problem for a lot of people. A lot of people aren't self aware, and so they're just doing the drugs, and they're just living their life, not really knowing that it's a problem. Do you feel as though that, like, how were you able to do that? Was it just getting so exhausting? Was it a money thing? Was it just getting in trouble? Like, what really made you look inside and say, you know, I got to get out of here because I feel as though that things aren't good?
I was just worn down.
Yeah.
I was worn down. I was very aware of what was going on.
Right.
There was nothing that was going to stop me.
Right.
Unless I got out of there.
Right.
And so I graduated in December
yep.
of 2000. 6.
Your family have any idea?
No, just right. drinking. They right. know I like to party.
Right.
But nothing other than that.
Right.
At this point. And so I moved to Florida in 2007. And Florida in 2007 happened to be when the opioid epidemic completely just broke through.
Right.
And it started to destroy lives. And it didn't take long for me to fall right down that trap, so to speak.
Especially down there, too, because you see these, and you could probably talk a little bit about it, these compound pharmacies and these pain clinics that are very, very, they're like literally in every corner in Florida, where you can just go to a doctor in his office, and you walk out of his office to the left, and it's the same building, and it's his pharmacy, and he's selling you the opioid. It's just this weird, I just can't believe that it still even exists. And then you hear about people up here and up north who will drive all the way down to Florida and just go to meet these doctors at these pain clinic, you know, mills, and they're just pumping these drugs out. And so you were down there when that was really starting to like become big business.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was easy, right? Wasn't it just easy?
It was easy, and it was dirt cheap down there.
Yeah.
Dirt cheap. We're talking like 3-4 times less than it would be up here. So, yeah, you had a bunch of people coming from up here down there. There's a documentary on it called The OxyContin Express.
Yeah, I think that's the one I saw, yeah.
It really breaks it down how it was, and that's what it was for me. I mean, I was involved in some way or another part of that for the next...
Tell me the difference between the two. So you got cocaine, which is a stimulant, which is in my understanding is it's going to get you... You know, again, that heightened level of awareness. You're awake. You're excited. You can't sleep, and you're the life of the party. And then I think of like an opioid of something that's going to do the opposite, where it's going to just mellow you out and calm you down. Is that the case, or is it different?
It's different for different people.
Okay,
you know, for sure. And for me, the high was light years ahead of cocaine. Cocaine wasn't really a high for me. It was just a party drug to keep it going.
Right.
With opiates, it became. It felt good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to lie. Absolutely felt good.
Right.
But just like with anything else, once you do too much of it and it takes hold of you, then it doesn't feel as good anymore. You have to do more and more and more.
Right.
I would personally get a lot done when I was on them.
Mm-hmm.
And what it also did, though, and I didn't realize this at the time, it turned me into a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was the one who reminded me of that because he knew every single time.
Right.
He was spot on, and I realized that my personality changed.
Right.
And that's when I truly realized there was an issue at hand with the cocaine. I knew it wasn't going to be something that would take me down.
Right.
With opiates, though, it was a different story. It really is.
And your brother is we'll call him in the law enforcement field at least. So he definitely deals with that, so he can kind of see that. But tell me a little bit about the ease. So how do you get, at least then, OxyContin? Like, how does it work?
I had someone I worked with who was prescribed to multiple doctors, like you
just
mentioned.
Yeah.
And
so you weren't doing it yourself? You weren't going to one of these pain pharmacies yourself? No.
No, I did have 2 surgeries
mm-hmm.
on my spine in 2009,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't start me with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that trying to wean off those. Just heightened what I needed to get more of the regular OxyContin.
Right.
Percocet and, you know, Darvocet, Vicodin didn't do much at all for me.
Really?
It was just straight OxyContin, oxycodone.
So isn't there a difference between OxyContin and oxycodone?
Yes.
Yeah.
The OxyContin is a lot stronger.
Yeah.
A lot stronger. And the oxycodone, I don't even know how to describe the actual difference.
Yeah.
I just know... It's much harder to get OxyContin, and they don't produce them anymore as far as
I
know.
Right.
And because they were, I mean, you get an 80 milligram pill versus up to a 30
mm-hmm.
milligram pill.
You know, okay.
So there's 50 milligrams right there.
Right.
And you start doing those, and same thing. It's the more you do it, the more you're going to have to get.
Right.
And so it's really the same thing in the end.
So was it describe for me like your day. So you'd wake up in the morning and what? So you wake up in the morning, you take it immediately or how does it work?
I would down there when I was in Florida.
Yeah.
I would get to work and I usually had one waiting for me on my desk.
Yeah.
From from someone who I worked with.
Right.
Needless to say.
Right.
And it helped me make a lot of money.
Right.
Make the company a lot of money.
Right.
And you know, that was once lunchtime hit.
Yeah.
Probably have to go get more.
Right.
And start the cycle up the next morning. But it wasn't where I just had to do maximum amount.
Right.
So it wasn't, I wouldn't say abusing it.
Right.
Then it was just I'd need it in the morning, then maybe in the afternoon.
Okay. So, when does it get to the point where now you're in Florida? When does it get to the point where you've kind of hit rock bottom there, and you know that now it's a major problem now?
Well, the financials started to come into play.
Yeah,
incidences where getting in trouble.
Yeah,
things that I started doing things I would never ever do.
Yeah,
if I was just normal Jason.
Right.
If I wasn't high or wasn't drinking.
Right.
And I lost every job, every girlfriend. So it started taking away the things that really mattered to me.
Right.
You know, baseball was long gone at that point. So now the new things that took over that I became in love with,
mm-hmm.
you know, became my passions, was work, which was I was in sales, which I loved.
Right.
And, you know, a girlfriend. And it just wiped out all those. It was just one after the
next. Did your girlfriend? What was your girlfriend's deal? Did she know? Was she also?
None of them knew. There wasn't just one.
Right. And they didn't know?
No.
But they found out at some point. They must have, right?
No one in Florida, as far as I know. Right.
Really?
No. It was hidden completely. No one knew.
Huh.
That's hard to do, isn't it? Manipulator.
Yeah.
When you're an addict, you absolutely can get away with anything. You learn how to get away with anything.
So, all right, so you're going through that stuff. You're in Florida, and, you know, again, so, folks, again, if you're listening right now or watching, we're on with Jason Hyland. He wrote the book Stop Thinking Like That. It's available on Amazon right now for pre-order. We're talking about his story, and his story is a very common one, you know, well, not all of it, but there's a lot of common elements to the story where you may have a family member or a relative that has gone through the same thing, and maybe they're going through it right now, and maybe they – you know, they're having trouble trying to get out to the other side, you know, and break through so that they can get back to the life that they know they want to live. So, you know, Jason's telling his story. It's a very, very inspiring story. It's a very, very honest story. I've read the book before it became available. So, you know, if you want to be inspired, okay, we're not all talking about, it's just about addiction, but it is about addiction. It's about recovery, and it's about inspiration, and about really overcoming anything. Again, hence the title, Stop Thinking Like That. So if you want some more information about Jason, you can just go to Jason-Hyland, and the last name is Hyland. You can also find him on through, you know, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, Jason R. Hyland. You started with the alcohol. Actually, we started with ecstasy. Ecstasy, alcohol, cocaine, OxyContin. You're in Florida. Things aren't getting any better. What happens next?
Well, I did what any addict would do, and I blamed it on the environment I was living in.
Right.
So in 2010, I moved back here.
Right.
So I was gone for roughly 10 years between Florida and California, and I moved back up here to get away from it all.
Right. Yeah. So when you move, so you move from California, figuring that I'm gonna leave here, I'm gonna go to Florida. And so you know that move, and somehow in your head is you're people don't know, like you said, but you're in a way trying to help yourself, at least you thought you were moving from one place to another, right?
Yeah,
that's kind of what you're doing,
like a fresh start,
right? So you knew that, all right, I'm gonna come. So at least your goal was, all right, I'm gonna go from California to Florida. I'm gonna stop doing drugs. And then you get to Florida. Did you know anybody when you moved to Florida?
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
So I moved back to Tampa where I went to school.
So that's a problem right there.
Okay.
So then you come back. Now you come back home. You come back to Massachusetts where we happen to be. We're here in Beverly, Massachusetts. And so what happens next?
It didn't take more than a couple months before I found more OxyContin.
Right.
And
well, did you? So at that point, you have to be full-blown addicted physically, right? No? So you could go days without it? Weeks?
Days, not weeks.
Yeah.
Probably. It was getting to that point.
Right.
You know, it wasn't to the point where I needed to have maximum every single day.
Okay.
You know, that's what I considered for me was when I was full-blown addicted. But
right.
Again, it was affecting everything I did.
Right.
Jobs, girlfriends, you know,
right.
Trouble with the law.
Right.
So, and my relationship with my family started to absolutely just deteriorate.
Right.
As I mentioned, my brother, Scott, he knew every single time.
Right.
He knew if I was doing it. And, of course, I would say, you're out of your mind. No, I'm not.
Right.
But I could, when I would hear myself now, I was like, wow, he was completely spot on. I sounded like a different person.
Right.
I didn't sound like who I was. And it's scary to think of because I had absolutely no awareness of that at the time, that I was, I guess, yeah, I was full blown into it at that point because it affected every area of my life.
Right. So you're back home now, and then as I'm, you know, listening to you tell your story, I mean, in the back of your mind, psychologically, there's definitely you must feel like you let people down, right?
Oh yeah.
Right. So you because you were supposed to be that kid coming out of high school that was going to be a professional baseball player, and now you're not, and that's got to hurt, right? It has to.
Absolutely. Yeah. I felt like I let myself down, obviously.
Right.
I let my family, all my friends, the community, my high school community, and then the community of Beverly.
Right.
Because it was always seen or thought that Jason Hyland is going to play Major League Baseball. That was just how it was.
Right.
Since I was in Little League, literally, is how far it goes back. So coming back here was difficult in regards to the shame and guilt I had.
Right.
I didn't want to, you know, go into Stop and Shop. I didn't want to run into people.
Right.
And so forth. But there was no really hiding anymore. And by the time I got up here, OxyContin was very prevalent up here.
Right.
And it was started to, you know, do what it's doing now, I guess you could say.
By the way, so just so you don't know this story, but I actually remember watching you practice at a tryout indoors at Beverly High School and when you were in Little League, and I'm a few years older than you, and that's exactly what people were saying at that point. You were being looked at, and you were like 10, I think. And people, you know, were saying, how are you going to go pro? So what he's saying is not just made up. I mean, I remember that because your brother was also a great athlete and also a great baseball player and even was looked at by some scouts as well. And so that was in the family. So, okay, so I don't want this whole thing about be all about the negative stuff. But so I'm thinking, I think, you know, there are so many people out there, and the reason why I wanted to talk about how you felt about your family members, because I think a lot of people have that some point in life where you feel like you just disappointed people, right? And you just feel like you let people down. But it's such a much bigger level, I think, from you, because since you were a kid, you were supposed to do all these things, and now you didn't. And here you are today. You've written a book, which is an amazing accomplishment. You know, you and I have been talking a lot about your book since pretty much the day you started. It's a big deal to get to where you're at today. How do you start to mentally change that process and just almost not forget about it, but just recognize that, hey, it happened. I'm still young. I have a lot of things I can do with my life. When does that start to happen? How do you do that? How do people do that? I know you talk a little bit about it in the book, but like, what happens? What's that moment? I think a lot of people feel. I know I'm trying to get you to answer the question, but I think a lot of people just feel like they're lost, and that it's over. That they fucked up so bad that it's just over, and that's not the case, is it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I was at that point.
Right.
For the last 3 to 4 years, was completely every single day was that point.
Right.
Every single day, I was drinking and drugging without my permission.
Right.
What that means is I didn't want to.
Right.
I didn't have any intention to. I didn't want to go to the Packy by 7:55 every morning. I didn't want to have to make 3 trips to Lynn every single day. I didn't want to do that. That was the last thing in the world I'd want to do. But I didn't know how to stop it. Mm-hmm. I also was completely consumed by it, and I gave up on the family. I felt they gave up on me, rightfully so.
Right.
Which, in reality, they didn't. Again, I was so mentally not there. I wasn't aware of they were trying to help me this whole time when I was just thinking they were just, I wrote about it it was an obsession.
Right.
Like, with alcohol, it was just an obsession I had, and it'll pass. But what I didn't realize is they understood that it was taken my life from me.
Right.
It took them, like me, completely away from them, and all the other stuff that I had in life that I was mentioning since Florida was getting taken away too. And it's just to the point where I don't want to spend any time with anyone. I don't want to be near. I don't care if you're my brother, my sister, my best friend, my girlfriend. I didn't want to be near anyone. And that rock bottom point, I wrote about that is I don't know which point it would be, because there are so many different instances where you think, okay, that's going to be the turning point where he's finally going to get it. That's going to be. And there really wasn't a point of that.
Right.
And it's hard to really.
Yeah, but how do you overcome it? Because I think a lot of people, again, they feel like just like they are in the people listening right now. And I had Matt Ganim on. I don't know if you watched that one. Who for 10 years he was a heroin addict. He wrote a book. He's now opening up rehab facilities all over the country. And you know, he talks about that. But and I think I know you're an avid reader. In the book Outliers, you know, there's that story about the woman who just lost everything, and then ultimately something just clicked. You know, what clicked for you? And how did you you know, how did you get there so other people can get there?
When I got the courage to say, help me.
Right.
The two most difficult words in an addict's vocabulary is help me.
Right.
No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Why do we not want to ask for help? Why does it take so long? Because we know how people are going to think about us.
Right.
That's kind of what I went into my speech last week about.
Right.
We understand how we're going to be perceived by others. We understand that the stigma that's going to be attached to us for the rest of our lives. And the shame and guilt, and we fear that, so we'd rather hide everything in.
Right.
Which was exactly what I was doing. So when the point came, July 23rd, 2017, that I just became honest. I guess the best way I overcame it, I surrendered.
Right.
I completely gave up. I had nothing left that I could possibly do to drink again, to drug again, to do anything, because mm-hmm. everything was completely gone from me. And I'm talking empty as could be.
Right.
And I spoke with my brother that day about some things that have happened. And
right.
I broke down and I was honest. I was honest for the first time in probably a decade.
Right.
Like complete honesty, like nothing held back.
Right.
And I told myself, okay, I went the next day, I got a bed in a detox facility. And I walked into that bed, and I say this often, I walked into that room, rather, with open arms.
How did you get that bed? Because, you know, I have family members that have gone into rehabs, detox centers, and there's a difference between the two, right? How did you get that bed? Because I've done it before for family members. It's not easy.
No.
So what'd you do?
Well, I knew of a place in Danvers.
Right.
And
that's the one I'm talking about, the CAB program, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And I contacted them, actually. I got a bed like 3 times that summer. Mm-hmm. So I was trying.
Okay.
I was trying to get the help, but I just I wasn't ready to completely give in and commit. And I just called. Everything that happened on the 23rd was meant to happen.
Right.
It's the best way I can describe it.
Mm-hmm.
And I called while I was at my parents' house. They lived down on the water, and I was looking out at the water, and I just called right then and there. I knew that there was going to be a bed open.
Right.
I knew that I was drinking at the time. That would be my last drink I'd have. And 9 a.m., I got a bed.
Right.
And so I walked into that facility. My mother dropped me off. The only time we really saw each other or spoke for a while, other than she would come to a couple AA meetings with
right.
me. She was trying so hard.
Right.
And I just, again, I couldn't see it. I couldn't accept it. I
right.
couldn't commit yet. So she dropped me off, and I walked in that facility just with those open arms. And I said to myself, and I said to whoever was there, do tell me what to do and I'll do it.
Right.
Just make sure I can never go back to that life. Whatever you tell me to do to assure that I will not go back to that life ever again, I will do.
Right.
I don't care what it is. I don't care how hard it is, how painful it is, how much blood, sweat, and tears I'm going to shed.
Right.
I will go through it to make sure that I never go back to that place, because it was hell, period.
Right.
This is the best way to, like, there's no other word for it.
So that place that you went to in particular, again, I know family members that went to it, but initially it's only a 7-day program, right?
Yeah.
And so I know they have an extended one called the HEAT program, I think it was called, or it used to be called that, which is like a 9-month extended thing. How did you get beyond the 7 days, or like there, or what happened from there? Because, you know, you're seeing rehab facilities pop up all over the place, and there's a reason why. There's two reasons why. One, because of the addicts, and two, because of the amount of money that's being made. So you made that phone call, probably got kind of lucky to get into that place. How do you stay there? And how long did you stay there for?
I was in the detox for 8 days.
Right. That's usually what it is, right? Yeah.
Yeah, 8 days. And when you get there, you pick 3 to 4 different places around the state that you want them to try to get you in for further treatment.
Right.
Which is called the holding, CSS.
Right.
Or TSS. And
right.
you can stay at those places anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months.
Do you need insurance?
No.
Okay.
MassHealth.
Okay.
MassHealth covers all this.
Right.
by the grace of God,
right,
that one.
Right.
So on the eighth day, they couldn't find a place for me. The only let me backtrack. The only place they found for me was in Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them, you're out of your mind.
Right.
I can't go back to that place. That is what just cut me down and brought me to my knees.
Right.
So they said, well, we can't find anything else. So I signed my paperwork, my discharge paperwork. I got my certificate for completion. And I'm waiting for the bus to come pick me up to bring me back to Beverly, not knowing what I'm going to do. I had no place to go home to live.
Right.
I had only the clothes that were in my bag.
Right.
No access to family, friends, anything.
Right.
And lo and behold, a gentleman who was supposed to go upstairs, which is Danvers has a CSS up there, he gave up his bed because his wife was in the waiting room, and he wanted to go home with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it was...
Is that the program I'm talking about? I thought it was called the HEAP program. Is that the one that's like 9 months or something like that? Is that the one?
No. I think it's all different now because Leahy
took it. Oh, because Leahy took it. All right. Okay. Yeah. All right. So, yeah.
So he left and then opened a bed upstairs.
Right.
And I just got on it and went to every person I could. Please give me that bed. Please give me that bed. And the next day I was upstairs.
Yeah.
And I was up there for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
During my initial... When they do all my paperwork and bring me upstairs.
Like your intake or whatever?
I have to have another intake.
Right.
I had the one at the detox. Now I have to do one into CSS. And the gentleman who was doing my intake asked me if I knew of a program called the Link House.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him I didn't. This was all new to me. I've never done this before.
Right.
And he's like, well, you seem like a good fit because he was going through my paperwork. And I was like, okay, can I get a little bit more information? He did. The next day, I called for my phone interview. And then you have to call every Wednesday to just check in to show them that you're still interested.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, the wait's 2 to 4 months. The 31st day of my entire, August 24th, I was in the Link House.
Right.
I went into the detox July 24th. So in less than 1 month, I went through detox, CSS, and now I was in the Link House.
Okay.
Which, again, typically 2 to 4 months. But everything just fell into place for me.
Right.
And those things were telling me, okay, this you're on the right track. You're doing the right thing. Just keep listening to what everyone tells you to do.
During that time, you know, so I think it's important that what you said earlier, that no one go back to what you said is our people. And I saw that speech, by the way. I didn't tell you about it, but it was an amazing speech. During that time when you submit to the fact that you realize those two difficult words of, you know, help me. So you're getting that help. What's going on in that facility as help? And because, again, the title of your book is Stop Thinking Like That. And I think it's a remarkable achievement to be where you're at today so quickly. And to be able to write a book in and of itself is amazing. But how do you change your mental state from that despair, and you're candid and you were suicidal and you felt like a failure? Like, so you're in there for the first, when does that start to change? When does your brain, because your brain chemistry physically changes. When does that start to happen? Is it something that happens in there? Are they saying to you, hey, read these books, do this, do that, therapy? What's going on inside?
Well, definitely none of the above about reading those books and therapy.
Right.
Because most of the people they see in there, they're doing what's a spin dry.
Right.
So they'll come in 7 days, 10 days, whatever the case, and, you know, sober themselves up enough till they go back out.
Right.
And what I learned,
sober themselves up enough so they can go back out and take the same drug or a little bit less of it and have that same high. And then what happens is they take the same amount they took before they went in, and then they overdose and die.
Absolutely. That, like, the number of times that's happened that I heard is, it's incredible.
Right.
And for me, like I said, I was just going to do whatever was told me. We would meet in groups. We had 3 groups a day. We had 2 commitments come in. Now, commitment is people from outside of the community who are sober, and whether it's through their AA program or through any of just a group that likes to come in and talk. So usually 2 to 4 individuals will come in and speak for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And when those started coming in, and I started hearing stories that, okay, these people are okay now. They're dressed nice. They're well maintained. They had their Dunk's coffee. I was completely envious of that stuff. And it's something so little, but it made me want, okay, I'm going to sit up front. I'm going to listen to what they said. And if I can find one thing from every single person that comes in here, which, again, is twice a day, then that's more for me moving forward, more for me to, you know, put in what's called a toolbox for if that situation comes up you know, further on in life, and just like more ammo to go.
So in a way, in a way, that is therapy. Is for, you know what I mean? It's great group therapy, right?
Yeah, group therapy,
right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and you're gonna get that group therapy. You meet with your counselor maybe once a week, but you're just going over
your progress,
and trying to get to somewhere else.
Right.
If you want further treatment,
right?
A lot of people don't. A lot of people after there, they just they go home, like we were saying,
right?
And for me, initially, I made a commitment of 90 days with my brother and my family, and after the 30 days, I was all in because it's a 6-month program at the Link House.
Okay,
and so it would be total 7 months for me away from family, friends, my dogs. And I said, 7 months for the rest of my life.
Right.
7 months for the rest of my life. 7 months for the rest of my life. I knew I could do it. I knew I had the capability to do absolutely anything. What my mom always said, you can do anything you put your mind to. Absolutely as true a statement as there is. If we really want something, which I talk about a lot in the book, if you really want something, you can go out and get it. It's
right.
just up to you to put in the work.
Right.
And so I knew from past successes, whether it's on the athletic field, in the classroom, and in jobs, that I always ended up being at the top of everything.
So there is, I guess, a lot of your own internal self-coaching and telling yourself that you can do that. And when you I'm thinking about what you're saying. You know, when you say leaving family, you know, fortunately, at least, you know, you weren't married with kids. You didn't have a mortgage and some of the stuff that a lot of people do have. You talked about in your speech, like what's your definition of an addict?
Yeah.
Is it that, you know, lawyer who's taking, you know, heroin during the day and someone doesn't know? Is it that doctor? Is it all these other people? So those people, they're so far into their lives and they get to the point maybe where they have given up and they're like, wow, now not given up. I mean, where they get to the point where they've submitted, so to speak. And they're like, well, 7 months, man, that's a long time. To be away from your kids, your job, but what's the alternative?
Absolutely, the alternative is to stay in what you're doing, which means you're going to become more depressed and more suicidal.
Right.
So there's really no alternative, and that's how I thought of it. There's nothing is going to be worse than where I was.
Right.
No matter what happens, nothing will be worse than where I was.
Right.
So why not give this a try? And the internal part is you're absolutely correct. As you mentioned, I like to read.
Right.
I read roughly 30 books in 5 months, the first 5 months of being in rehab. And every single book was on personal development.
Right.
Positive mindset and other addiction stories that, you know, with positive results.
Sure.
And that just got ingrained in me because...
How did that happen? Why did you start reading the book? Did someone tell you you should? Or what? Or were you just bored?
Well...
Or both?
Maybe a little bit of both. For the last 4 years or so, my mother was, she knew I had a real bad problem. She was always trying to get me to stop. And when we weren't talking, she'd send me books from Amazon with a little note in it. And I had a collection of them because I never opened them. And so when I left, I brought them with me. And after reading a couple or so, it really started, things started clicking. Because before I got completely consumed in the opiate epidemic, I was reading a lot of Tony Robbins, Napoleon Hill, that my boss was giving me.
Right.
That stuff clicked with me real quick.
Right.
And I saw it, and I saw the vision. I saw that stuff is possible.
Right.
If, you know, again, if what I always can say is conceive, believe, achieve.
Right.
You know, and it's so true. So I slowly but surely started having more books brought in. And if I heard of a book, I would ask my mother to get it for me. And thankfully, she obliged because she saw the change. And my whole family slowly but surely saw the change happening, and I saw the change happening.
And I think that's important because I think a lot of people don't like to read. But when you had mentioned the term toolbox, that, you know, the reading these books, these self-help books, the mental health, the positive thinking, the personal development books are giving you the tools to make yourself stronger. I mean, it's just a fact.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And from being in 7 months within two programs, well, three technically, I was around a lot of people who completely gave up on life, a lot of people who just couldn't get over what they've done in their past, just completely consumed by everything they've already done. So they were letting it affect everything they were doing now and moving forward. So there was basically no hope.
Right.
And it drove me nuts. When I was in the Link House, you got to meet with your therapist once a week. And I would say it to her, I'm like, why aren't these people trying to get better? Why does it? But what I don't understand at the time is everyone comes in at a different point.
Right.
You know, and like you mentioned, people come in with families, you know, careers and so forth that they lose.
Right.
But I go back to, well, anyone can do this.
Right.
If I can, why can't anyone else? All I did was have a different mindset.
Right.
I truly, that was the number one thing that got me through 6 months in one house with, you know, I'm living with upwards of 18 different addicts and 18 different personalities from 22 years old to 65 years old. To get through that, it's not easy, but you have to have, you know, a strong mental game behind you.
Right.
Or you're going to let some of the littlest things take over. And I've seen it happen, and unfortunately so many people who don't end up finishing the program are already out there again. And it's unfortunate and it's sad to see. But for me, there was no alternative. There was just absolutely no alternative. And I got this feeling in me that you need to do more. You just got saved for whatever reason. At that point, I didn't understand why. But you need to do more. I saw how great things, you know, seemed to be working for me just by reading and writing. Everyone's going to have something different. But by what I was reading and what I was listening to on YouTube when I would go to the library, I could see it changing in me. So why can't other people do it? And if they can't, well, maybe I can help them.
Right.
Help them do it.
Right.
And that's where the book kind of came into play. Something was just telling me to keep writing.
Right.
To keep writing. Now, 3 months into sobriety, people are like, all right, kid, just stay sober.
Right.
When I tell them I'm going to write a book.
Right.
Because who's thinking you're
going to
write a book?
Again, that's the negative thinking, right? I mean, they're not thinking like you, even though you can understand what they're saying, but that's being negative, right? I mean, just plain and simple. If you hadn't read some of those other books right before, maybe you would have just given up, but...
Yeah, very possibly.
Right.
And what I always think about is there's always an exception to everything.
Right.
If there wasn't, we wouldn't have some of the great people of our time.
Right.
We wouldn't have... certain individuals, Zuckerberg, Steve Jobs,
right.
So forth.
Right.
Obviously, I'm not comparing myself to them.
Right.
But they went against the norm.
Sure.
They went against everyone telling them you're crazy.
Right.
No way. You're
right.
Not worthy.
Right.
And basically, that was what I was doing. At the end of the day, and I told my stepfather, I told Paul this, if I write a book, if I finish this and nothing else comes of it, I can say I wrote a book, which is pretty damn cool.
Right.
And it kept me sober.
Right.
So it's a win-win no matter what.
Right.
And that's the subtitle to my book, No Matter What, actually.
Right.
Because we get these bans when you graduate the Link House. And it's just a...
It says No Matter What?
It says No Matter What, Link House on the other side.
Yeah.
And we get these to remind ourselves, no matter what, don't pick up. It doesn't matter what the situation, what's going on, how bad it may be, do not pick up.
What does that mean, do not pick up?
Don't start drinking or drugging.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it stuck with me. So once I knew we got these, it's when I added it to the book, which was, you know, a couple of months in.
Does it get easier? I mean, you know, and here's another thing. And when you think about, you know, where you're at, you're not that far. I mean, it's an amazing accomplishment, but every day they say it's a struggle. I don't know. Fortunately, I've been, you know, I've just been lucky, I guess. But does it get easier? Is it getting easier? Do you, I know you probably hear this question a lot. Do you wake up every day? Are you thinking about drugs? Are you thinking about drinking? Can you go to a bar and hang out? Like, you know, what's it like, you know, in recovery?
Well, I can honestly say since the day I stepped into a detox, I have not had one urge to have a drink.
Right. But that's not, that can't be common.
No.
Right.
It's definitely not. Mm. I'm on certain medication. Maybe that's a big part of it.
Right.
Which I got in March, but I never took until... You know, there's 4 more months I could have had, but it all happened the way it was supposed to.
Sure.
That and...
So there are medications that are out there. I don't know. We don't need to get them, but I know there are things like Suboxone that are out there. I don't know if there's other ones that might, but that help people. So for those who feel like they're not mentally strong enough, there are things that can help that hopefully isn't just going to be, you know, an alternative to the drugs that they're taking, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
I'm personally not on any of those in regards to my opiate habit, but people that are, you know what, it's keeping you from putting a needle in your arm, then absolutely take it every day.
Right.
That's a whole other topic on the stigmas. People who are taking Suboxone or Methadone or the Vivitrol shot, they're looked down upon like they're still taking a drug,
right?
So they're not completely clean,
right?
Well, that's bullshit in my eyes because he's not sticking a needle in his arm. He's not putting his life in jeopardy,
right?
Or others in jeopardy at the time,
right?
And it's keeping him clean, to or him or her, to what what they're trying to do. So those drugs are absolutely critical for some people. And I was on Suboxone about 4 years ago, and it worked for me.
Right.
It worked for me for 4 years.
Right.
And if I didn't have that, I don't know if I would even be here, to be honest with you.
So we've been. This might be one of my longest podcasts. We've gone a little bit over an hour, and I want to kind of bring it full circle. First of all, I want to have you back because I'd love to talk to you about some of my concerns. I think with the drug epidemic, and I love the fact that you're out there trying to do something. If someone who's listening right now is watching right now, who's you know, in a bad situation, struggling with addiction, really feel like there's no hope. What sort of advice can you give them right now?
Well, if they can see me right now, I'm the living example. If they can hear me, my voice is an example. Because 8.5 months ago, I was going through people's trash collecting cans so I could buy nips the next day. I was stealing endless amounts of money from my family. I was thinking of ways of how to end my life. I didn't have any family, friends. My body was completely, I didn't recognize myself, to be honest, and no one did. And to be sitting here, that's proof that it can happen to anyone. Anyone can get to where I'm at or get to a point where they're happy with their life if they want it. It's really as simple as that. If you want change, then you'll change. You know, nothing changes if nothing changes. You hear that a lot in the recovery community. So if you want it, you can have it. Now, I know that might seem like you're completely hopeless and there's nothing going on for you, but what I just said to you, look where I was. Do you think I had any hope? Do you think I had any, ambition or drive to, I'm still going to live out the life I want? Absolutely not. But all it takes is that, taking that first step. If you take that first step in the right direction, take the first step forward in the next step, in the next, everything falls into play for you. And it truly does. As long as you continue moving forward, the past happened. Absolutely, there's nothing that's going to do to change that. All you can do is learn from it. All you can do is use that to make yourself a better person. Learn from it. So if those situations come up again, now you know how to handle it. Now you have a better grasp on, the circumstances surrounding things. And once you start getting the days behind you, you start seeing your body physically change back to normal. Like just showering and brushing my teeth, things that I would do maybe once a week when I was at my worst. You start becoming a little more confident, like, I think I can do this. I think I can do this. Oh, my mother says she wants to come see me. Oh, I get a message from someone, with encouragement. That those things fall into place. It truly does. And it's crazy to think from someone on the outside looking in who doesn't understand addiction or recovery. But if you're doing the right things, things will fall into place for you. It just takes getting up, taking that one step forward. Once you do that, sky's the limit. I truly believe that. I'm living proof of it. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, because I want others to understand that they can, too, live out the life that they always wanted. It's not the end of the world just because you're in recovery. And a lot of people think that, too. They're like, oh, I'm in addiction. If I get better, I'm still in recovery. Well, you can do whatever you want. It's up to you.
Right.
And that's the best way I can put it. Just grab on to anything that can just get you up off the ground and one step forward, and then things fall into place.
I love it. I love it. Again, folks, we've been on with Jason Hyland. He's the author of Stop Thinking Like That. It's available on Amazon right now for pre-order. He's got an amazing story. It's been probably one of the longest podcasts I've had on because he's a real guy, and he really put it out there. And there are a lot of people, whether it's you listening right now, watching right now, or it's a family member, and you're struggling and you feel as though that there isn't a way out. Pick up Jason's book. You can also find some more information about Jason at Jason-Hyland. It's HYLAND.com. You can find him on Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, Jason R. Hyland. Again, last name is HYLAND. And again, this book is already changing people's lives. He's committed to helping other people, and it's a really, really inspiring book, and it's a great read too as well. I read it, had an opportunity to read it before, so pick it up. It's available for pre-order right now on Amazon. Stop Thinking Like That by Jason Hyland. Jason, thanks so much for being my guest. My name is Michael Alden, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, I hope you're enjoying the Alden Report as much as I am. I'm having so much fun bringing you cutting edge information and from entrepreneurs, from thought leaders, from authors all over the world. And I'm really excited to announce something. I'm speaking this September of 2018 at the Future Tech Expo in Dallas, Texas. It's actually September 14th, 15th, and 16th, and I'm speaking there. It's an amazing event. It's one of the biggest blockchain, Bitcoin, and tech expos in the world. People like Tim Draper and Randy Zuckerberg are going to be there, and you can rub elbows with some of the smartest people in this world. September 14th, 15th, and 16th. If you text BLUEVASE, again, text BLUEVASE to 555-888, you can be my VIP. I'm going to give you some discounted tickets, but you can also be my VIP. There's an opportunity as well to have dinner with me and my team, and we're going to sit down and we're going to talk about this world of cryptocurrency, of Bitcoin, of blockchain, and the future of technology. Again, text BLUEVASE to 555-888. If you want to be involved in this world, if you want to grow in this world, if you want to take advantage of the biggest opportunity of your life, then you need to be at events like the Future Tech Expo. Again, text BLUEVASE to 555-888. I'll see you there.